I'm Mark Mielke, Executive Director of the Aristotle Foundation for Public Policy. The Aristotle Foundation is a new think tank in Canada. We will be dedicated to reason, democracy, and civilization. There's a lot under those three columns. We do have a charitable application underway, but when we launch later this year or early in 2023, we'll have some content under reason, democracy, and civilization. You can find us at www.aristotlefoundation.org. So that's aristotlefoundation.org or aristotlefoundation.com or .ca. We'll get you there as well. One of the things we want to do, though, before we officially launch is give people a bit of a preview of some of the matters and issues and some of the podcasts we will do. And one of them will be interviews with a contrarian. And today we're going to be talking to our latest contrarian, I think it's the best way to put it, is Lydia Perovich, if I've got the last name correctly, Lydia. And she has written a new book just published by Sutherland House, and it's called Lost in Canada, An Immigrant's Second Thought. So let's just jump into it today and begin discussing the book. But welcome, Lydia.
Thank you so much.
And you're in Toronto, I believe.
Yes, I am. Yes.
Well, welcome to Interviews with a Contrarian. So let's start with the question you probably get all the time. It's the easy question, and we'll unpack this over the next hour. Why did you write Lost in Canada?
I have noticed the country to which I had moved changing beyond recognition in some aspects. So I come from the Balkans, which is now called the Western Balkans, which is the part of the Balkans that is not admitted in the EU. So we're forever in the waiting room for the EU. But it used to be communist Yugoslavia, which, as some of your viewers will know, fell apart in a civil war, in a series of civil wars. And so I came to Canada in 99, when just the last one of those wars, the NATO bombing of Serbia, Montenegro over the war on Kosovo, was wrapping up. And I got a scholarship to study political theory at Dalhousie, and I jumped at the opportunity. I mean, in all honesty, I didn't know a whole lot about Canada. A lot of Europeans just know about Canada, something that's next to the US, over which the American culture kind of spills. It's sort of like a periphery of the American empire, if you want. But I did know a few things, and I thought, okay, this can't be that much different than the US, let's do it. And what happened in the next 10 to 20 years is the complete reversal. I totally lost interest in every other place in the universe being American. And I've become something of a Canadian cultural nationalist. And nationalism was a terrible word in the Balkans and Europe in general. Today I'm astounded how American Canadians have become. And it's not a problem anymore. It used to be a bit of an issue in the 70s, 80s, when we were interested in building our culture. But now we just lap up every single culture war issue, every single Netflix streaming, every single streaming service. We just take it almost uncritically as if it's universally relevant. So what I've noticed in the last, let's say, 5 or 6 years, is that the so-called institution, the meaning-making institutions of public schooling, universities, the media, the public broadcaster at CBC, have changed radically. Free speech was toppled as one of the ideals, freedom of assembly, freedom of query, in institutions like university, which was astounding to me. There are other values now that are more important than those basic liberal liberties. So that's an interesting turn for me. Also, I suppose in order to redress some historical injustices, a lot of jobs now come with specified ethnic group described in the job ad. And that is just for somebody whose ethnic resentments and ethnic divisions have been destroying my continent forever. It's highly unusual. It's highly unusual. I mean, I understand that you-
Well, you're being polite. Unusual is one word.
I understand you want to have more people of all kinds of backgrounds, but to explicitly exclude a whole spot of ethnic groups, that's quite new to me. That's very new. And then, as I mentioned, another thing that changed is we've given up on our culture and our arts journalism as well. I kind of could earn over the last 12 years, I could earn half a living to two thirds of a living to, you know, it's fluctuating, by writing about arts and culture. And that's completely wrecked. That's completely gone. We don't have any criticism left, save maybe a couple of people who write about theater and the movies in the Globe. And I mean, people ask me, so why is that important? Well, if journalism is the first draft of history, then arts and culture journalism is sort of a first draft of a culture, of national conversation. And I think if that's gone, I told you this earlier, this is a cliche, but yeah, we're kind of safely on a path towards becoming an Ohio.
An Ohio.
Yes.
American state. Well, let's unpack a little bit of this. And yes, I forgot to read your bio at the beginning. And for those of you that don't know Lydia, she did move to Canada in 1999, as she said, and has since worked in publishing, education, bookselling, and arts funding. And she's the author of two novels, and she writes the long play newsletter on Substack. And for those of you who don't know where Montenegro is, it's north of Albania and across the Adriatic Sea from Italy. If you look on a map, you'll find it, the former Yugoslavia, of which it was once part. Let's unpack a little bit of this. I mean, there's lots of interesting stuff in your book, Lost in Canada and Immigrant Second Thoughts. One of the things, though, is the concern about Americanization. Now, this has been rife throughout Canadian history. My PhD thesis was on anti-American rhetoric in Canada, and you and I talked offline about this. What I noticed, though, was anti-Americanism in Canada used to come from the right, you could say. These are broad terms, but broadly speaking, the right was concerned about, say, American moral influences in the 1920s, right? Trashy magazines and the rest of it. And then it became a left-wing phenomenon, I would say, post-1960s. And of course, the United Empire Loyalists would be considered, I don't know if they'd be considered right or left, but certainly the more conservative traditional element of English Canada, British Canada, again, prior to the 1960s, was always concerned about Americanization. Now, I probably take a slightly different view. Part of this, I think, is a hang up from, you know, the British Empire losing the Americans in 1776. even though we won the War of 1812, this fear of a smaller country of a larger country, but nonetheless, it's long been there. And it's certainly dominant in central Canada. And as part of the narrative here, there. Whereas in Western Canada, where I grew up, and in Alberta, where I live now, more of a frontier culture, there's less, I guess, fear of Americanization or vice versa. And we can go into this a bit later as well. But I take your point. There is this concern about the Canadian national identity. But let's jump into that a little bit. And you quote Northrop Frye, or talk about Northrop Frye in your book. Is part of the problem, though, that there was a more distinct Canadian identity, but frankly, it was British, you know, along with the French overlay or the French compromise. And is that part of the problem, bluntly said, is that it's not very popular to defend, you know, colonialism, the British presence in Canada, but that was, at least in English Canada, the identity of Canada until 1960s, 1970s, for good or ill. Is that part of the problem, that we've dispensed with, you know, sort of an appreciation of the historic British presence in Canada, if I can put it that way?
I think we've always been separate. I don't think that the Brits took particular pride in our colonies. They were really not overdeveloped. Our borders are fairly tightly controlled. I mean, when you compare the history of immigration to US with the history of immigration to Canada, we're kind of wanted to be like British backwater, but I'm thinking of
Toronto, like in the 1950s, for example. I remember seeing a picture of a subway.
Oh, you mean the 20th century? Yes.
Toronto the Good, right? They would celebrate the Queen, the moniker. You'd see massive amounts of support for that, right? And politicians would have to cater to kind of the British influence, which, yes. Various writers and artists and others over the decades said was fading, and they were concerned about that. And immigration, of course, which is I'm in general supportive of, also takes that historical memory and dilutes it further, which is, again, in one sense, fine. And Pierre Trudeau tried to create a multicultural Canada, as you know, in part to combat French nationalism. It's already gone. But so I wonder if part of this concern about Americanization is, you know, it's self-reinforcing when we dilute, say, the historic milestones in Canada, whether it's canceling John A. Macdonald or other other historic achievements, the liberalism you talk about in Lost in Canada, you come across as a classical liberal, right? You value these classical liberal freedoms as, you know, perhaps articulated by John Stuart Mill in the 19th century, not a more modern liberalism, say post-Trudeau. Or the woke version these days, the more progressive woke liberalism, or if you can combine all those words. So is that part of the problem, though? We've kind of cut the ties to our historic British presence, is what I meant.
I don't think it would have sustained us anyway.
Okay.
I'm not opposed. It's a big debate what official multiculturalism did, whether it diluted something. I don't think it diluted anything because it was so thin. It was so thin. There were some institutions on the ground and some culture slightly derived from Britain, but there was no, and I use this term very broadly, indigenous culture, Canadian indigenous culture. I think that added fuel, like the opening of the immigration added fuel. And of course, we absolutely, in economic terms, we need 200,000 people a year, probably, because we are so widespread and so there's so few of us, like the population of Poland, basically. But what I think is getting lost is, I mean, we always jostled. We always had an issue with unity. Look at the regions, even before the opening of immigration. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does somebody in the Maritimes have in common with somebody in BC? It's a very difficult question.
Yeah.
And you could argue we're effectively five or six countries, two legal systems, two right. languages, and now is a third set of legal system that is emerging with indigenization of laws, of certain laws and certain courts. Perhaps I should have defended that a bit more. What unifies us is the English language. So with the English language, there's a whole heritage that comes up, which is also the Commonwealth heritage, right. which has all kinds of connections to other rest of the globe, the Caribbean, India, Africa, China. Mm-hmm. And it's a globally dominant language. So, right. I mean, it's an interesting question whether now the Anglosphere is in effect one country.
Right.
Because we're all reading each other. We're all talking to each other. Our universities are, professors are interchangeable. So,
right.
But
let's go down that road, Lydia, in terms of, because you're right, there's always been American influence. I mean, was it Pierre Trudeau that said we're the mouse next to the elephant or something like that? If I remember the quote vaguely correctly. But you mentioned, so there's always been this American influence, right? And it may or may not be increasing, but nonetheless, it's there. And you talk about early in the book, these U.S. culture wars and Black Lives Matter. And You speak about the tragedy. There's no longer a Canada for all. And it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, 1960s Vietnam era protests and the rest of it, you know, are one example of on the left wing of the spectrum in, you know, issues that arose in Canada, you know, Simon Fraser University protests in British Columbia over the Vietnam War in the late 1960s, early 1970s, or more recently, what you point to is U.S. culture wars. Can you explain a little bit more about U.S. culture wars and where you see these erupting in Canada? Because it's a good example of U.S. influence just imported holus bolus into Canada.
Absolutely. Well, it's the race discourse more than anything and how it manifests. I mean, if you look at the rest of the world, I don't think there's another country in which the concept of race is as important as is the case in the U.S. I mean, if you look at Europe, we hate each other on all kinds of different bases: language, nationality, history, culture, like, not race. Race is just completely irrelevant. When you read people like Thomas Chatterton Williams, who lives in France and is a mixed race American, he writes about how race is completely useless in France. It's you're just the French of a different ethnic background. Like, and I mean, if you look in the past, I mean, we have dropped as a humanity, fortunately, and North America in particular, terms of yellow race and red race as ridiculous, but we somehow cling to black and white. And it's because it's so crucial for the American stories that they tell themselves and how they do their history. And it's hugely important in universities, and it's just a top concept. And because of that, and because they're so globally dominant, now we're all talking about race. I mean, even Montenegro had a Black Lives Matter protest, and we hadn't had any blacks in Montenegro for a long time. In Canada, I think how it translates, it translates slightly differently conceptually, in that instead of the white and black divide, really enamored in with settler and indigenous divide now. And I just cannot, I mean, I have my theory why we're so overinvested in it.
Why? Maybe, what is that theory? Would you expand
it
on
could that? It could be some sort of strange yearning for deep history, for deep, dark European, Asian, African history, where there was a lot of genocide, a lot of wars, a lot of conquering, waves and waves of people. And in terms of history, I mean, Canada is pretty uneventful. I mean, even the War of 1812, which is one of the important wars for us, it's only relevant for us, basically, was a draw between the U.S. and the British Empire.
So we don't have a grand history in that sense, right? We're kind of a patchwork of compromises. I mean, even the founding of Canada was really, and I wrote about this in one of my books, Taxman Canadian, the early politicians, I mean, pre-Confederation, George Brown and others and John A. Macdonald, they were concerned about tariffs being imposed by one province on another. It was a commercial founding, in essence, but it was a patchwork compromise. And of course, again, vis-a-vis the American threat, right? Post-1812, the concern that one day the Americans might take parts of the Pacific Northwest more than they already did, or other parts of Canada. And so in one sense, we've got a boring history, I guess. I mean, that's not entirely fair, but you're right. So is that part of the, you know, is it kind of like a suburban family, the kid of a suburban family who, you know, he's got great parents, you know, he's done well. I mean, he doesn't really have any issues, but he invents them because he needs to have some sort of serious, you know, teenage crisis.
Especially if he lives next to a crack house.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
That's that cliche. Like, we're the little old lady on top of a crack house. I think we're trying. I don't think we see ourselves as a country anymore. Mm. I mean, you vis-a-vis the indigenous settler divide. I mean, you now regularly see ads for, say, writing residency that says Canadian and Indigenous, as if those two are you cannot reconcile them. And that's a new moment for me. That's completely. And I think that's conceptually taken out of the U.S. the way they treat. Deal with black and white differences. And I think it's a very strange, I mean, things like nation to nation rhetoric has become completely normal. Does anybody not question what that means? I've experienced failing states. I've experienced two legal systems clashing and not merging. I've experienced, you know, regional separatism, and it's not fun, people. It's not fun to treat one of your own ethnic minorities as this separate nation that has its own table. Everybody else, immigrants, settlers, everybody, we're just, you know, at this one table where there's messy and there's everything happening. And then there's a special table for this one ethnic group. And as you probably notice, I argue in the book, our history was so interchanged, so intertwined, the indigenous and settlers, that I think it's an artificial distinction to make now. Because the
you don't point this out, but you're right. You do write in Lost in Canada about various Indigenous First Nations, as we call them today, taking the side of the French or taking the side of the British, right?
Absolutely. And it wasn't like, oh, we're helpless Indigenous people now. It's strategic thinking. It's political thinking among the tribes. And they've taken sides. They've made their own decisions. They have been a historical subject. And it's extraordinary to me that somehow this division is, oh, we introduced all the ills and they were untouched nature, and they remain somehow through all these centuries, remain a special relationship to nature and conservancy.
Is this a romantic Rousseau-like view of Indigenous history in Canada and pre-contact, as people like to say? Yeah. And they're not historically informed. Because these days, it seems everyone has their own truth, which is a ridiculous concept we can get into, but your truth, my truth. So what, there are no historical facts about slavery in British Columbia pre-contact I mean, widening it up to North America and Mexico, Aztecs and sacrifice. I mean, really, the Americas were a pure, unblemished model of Edenic, civilization before, some people came over from Europe and imported their own conflicts, the French and English later. So you're on to something there for sure in the book.
And we never,
is it romantic and Rousseau? I mean, at heart, is that what this is?
Yeah, I think so. But they're not aware that it's a very old European discourse that preceded the creation of liberal democracies, which is an abstract experiment. What happened before we had laws that are equal for all, that we unified our country. And of course, Rousseau was optimistic about what came before laws and private property. Mm. Other people thought, well, we already had hierarchies, we already had labor, we already have different kinds of things. So it's such a 17th and 18th century conversation that we go back to now, completely untouched by history. And I mean, every ethnic group today in Canada lives in this age. Mm-hmm. To somehow presume that one ethnic group lives in some prehistoric times, or everybody was a hippie and they just moved around and there was no hierarchy between men and women. And it's just extraordinary to me. And this love of the word decolonization, like, that's so fascinating to me. Universities put this in their press releases, professors put this in syllabus. And it's a completely meaningless word. What could it mean? But the university is giving up its property? What are they donating to? Like, what's that? Or let's say you live in Toronto, you own a house, you own a cottage. What does that mean? You're on stolen land? You have a sign that says we're on stolen land, we acknowledge. Like, okay, what does that mean? Are you in favor of abolishing of private property? What's the argument here? Are we abolishing financial capital?
It's not well defined. It seems to be a combination of, for lack of a better phrase, white liberal guilt, plus this Rousseau notion of, we've got to get back to Eden, and those of us who have any ancestral ties to Europe are the problem. Is it almost a revolutionary approach? It's another revolutionary ideology that says we can start from year zero, and people don't realize. I mean, you talk about this in Lost in Canada, Lydia. I mean, and I sense this tension in your book. You appreciate kind of the rootedness of Europe, but you also recognize that that was part of the problem, right? I mean, how do you get over that? And one experiment has been the European Union, and it may have gone a little bit too much in one direction, right? Trying to tie people together that are not wanting to be tied together too closely, as opposed to a free trading zone. So maybe the EU
with very austere economic institutions. Let's be clear about that. I mean, the European Central Bank is not a charity.
Right.
By any means, as we know. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So is that a big part of it then? Is this notion of, starting from year zero, which is again another mistake if you understand anything about movements that try and start things over from scratch.
Well, it's very. I mean, we had a case of decolonization recently in Hong Kong. So that's a case of decolonization. I mean, maybe people
over the objections of the Hong Kongers who appreciated the British commitment to the rule of law, liberty. I mean, I don't think you and I talked about this offline, but when I was in Hong Kong in 2013, unlike Canada, the business people I talked to, the civil servants and some politicians said they basically wanted to keep the British rule of law, capitalism, and the British legal system because it wasn't corrupt, like what was coming from Beijing, what they feared and what has happened. So it's a very different narrative in Hong Kong among those, especially, and of course, a lot of Hong Kong was settled by people post 1949 who fled communism in China. But let's go back to your book and jump into a little bit more about that, because, you note these culture war imports from the United States. You note, though, that the difference between the culture wars in the United States that are now imported into Canada, but race, is not just that down there it's white and black, and here it's what are non-Indigenous versus Indigenous, or not versus, but certainly that's the divide. But it's also that down in the United States, at least there's some pushback, there's some critical thinking about whether this is identity politics is a really good idea. So you mentioned Glenn Laurie, you mentioned other academics and critics of this, John McWhorter, the English professor from Massachusetts, I believe. So why is there not more criticism in Canada and warnings of the danger of identity politics? And you talked about it a moment ago. To me, it's very ironic when some First Nations leaders, not all, and those sympathetic to this identity politics view and this historic guilt approach, they don't realize that this is a very European approach to divide up in ever smaller, republics and principalities. And then you end up with people punching each other out and worse.
And it's completely inaccurate. We've intermarried since forever. I mean, a lot of these Indigenous activists are half Polish or quarter Indigenous, eighth Indigenous. It's a stupid thing to try even to find, but what is a purebred? There's no, I don't think there such a thing exists, but still some people want a procedure that would show that somebody is indigenous enough, or I understand that goes back to the early colonization, but it's something that should have been looked at ages ago anyway. But there's more WASPness in some of these indigenous activists than there is in me or a lot of other immigrants, right? So it's kind of pretend. We're all pretending there's just the eighth of this person, the fourth of this person, and some cultural practices somehow overdetermine them. And they are only that and nothing else but that. And that's very strange to me. So maybe this is the heavy European history speaking for me, but I don't think it's wise. I don't think it's wise that we're doing this.
What do you think Pierre Trudeau would have thought of this approach?
Ha. He would have hated it. And in a way, he started it all with the celebration of different ethnic groups. But he was so enamored with universality. It's one of the few, I think he was one of the few people in Canadian history who really hated particularism, and he just wanted some things to be universal, and he didn't. And he was, of course, emblematic anti-separatist for Quebec, which is why he's so hated and loved in Quebec. And so he started from his own background. He started from his own village when he talked about universalism, and he did have a vision. I try to raise, because Janet Eisenstadt mentions him in her book. I went to some of his essays. I mean, he wasn't a brilliant writer, but I think we should still read his essays from the time when people really wanted to read from him. He was inventing Canada at that point, like a big heady time of invention of Canada as this universalish liberal democracy.
Well, it does seem that Pierre Trudeau was mostly consistent on his liberalism insofar as it was applied to the individual, right? I think he was deadly, you know, wrong in economics, and he flirted with Mao and Stalin and the rest of them, or flirted with the communism a little bit, you know, perhaps as a half joke and half serious when it came to Fidel Castro and Mao. Not Stalin, perhaps, but
that was to piss off Americans.
Yeah, fair enough. But he also, you know, seemed to think socialism was the way of the future and the rest of it. Nonetheless, when it came to identity, he was certainly a consistent liberal of the 19th century variety in the, in the train of Wilfrid Laurier, right? Who there's this quote I have in one of my books that I dug up about Wilfrid Laurier, but basically celebrating, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of commerce. And he goes on to say, this is Canada. This is in an 1896 speech in Winnipeg, as I recall. This was also very much Pierre Trudeau. So although I think he was wrong in some of his international relations trips, so to speak, and sympathies, and in his economics, I think when it came to the individual, he saw the individual as paramount in law and policy, which is why he hated Quebec separatists and fought with everything he had. Now, his son, though, comes along and says, we are a post-nationalist state. What do you make of that?
I think it's an interesting idea. I mean, the U.S. in a way is a post-ethno-nationalist state as well. And there are a few countries like this that kind of, if not in practice, are post-nationalists, if not by program. So, I mean, France is pretty, it's getting there. The UK is fairly like that. And the US is very much like that. And Canada is used to be like that. But of course, the US has this civic nationalism. And the US has now this whole new set of divisions that goes back to the Civil War divisions from the Civil War that have never been extinguished. For them, you can argue they are two different countries that perhaps should not have stayed in union. But
let's go back to that in a moment. But in terms of post-nationalism, should we make a distinction though between, say, post-ethnicity and post-nationalism? Because to me, I think you need a certain nationalism or a certain unifying creed, and you're identifying what you wanted to see in Canada, which you came to in Canada in 1999, was liberal again in the 19th century sense, with the rights of the individual in law and policy. We're not going to assign you a place in society based on the fact that you're a woman or a Catholic or Jewish or Black, or, you know, and of course we failed miserably with Indigenous people before 1960, when only then did they have the vote restored. But nonetheless, the ideals of 19th century liberalism were paramount, especially under Pierre Trudeau, but even John Diefenbaker, who restored the vote in Parliament to Indigenous people and fought against Quebec on their discrimination against Jehovah's Witnesses. So this, again, this paramountcy of the individual, which we've lost, but don't we need a few unifying things? I mean, in the United States, it is, look, you know, the founding, narrative of 1776, and the fact that, no, you can't separate in the South and keep slaves, you know, the Civil War, which added to it. So that's part of their founding. I don't want to say myths, these were real events, but their founding narrative. Yeah. So I think every country needs something. You need a basic agreement of, you know, whether you're a liberal democracy or an autocracy in Singapore. So you need a founding myth or a founding narrative. Plus, you need to have agreement on the basics. We're going to settle elections peacefully, which is what Donald Trump and some of his supporters seem to be opting out of, which is why it's so dangerous or reckless. Reckless is probably a better word. To found out of that opting agreement about what the United States is. But in our case, for the prime minister to talk about a post-national Canada, it seems to me either naive or disingenuous. And most people would agree you don't want Canada to be built upon an ethnicity. We're past that, or should be, you know, exception of Quebec. But because you're from Europe, is that because you like the French model, is that not France, where they say, yeah, you know, we don't care about what you look like or your gender, we're going to treat you as an individual in law and policy. That is still their ideal.
But they have very strong national culture. So they have a whole bunch of narratives for you to pick and choose from, centuries of literature and opera and music and everything. No, I agree. I mean, had you interviewed me when I was 25 and so saturated with the Balkan neurosis, I would have said, no, who cares? It's just whatever. You don't need it. You do need a nationhood. Mm-hmm. And I describe it in the book. I like Ernest Renan's definition, which is this great solidarity, so across all kinds of differences and across time, so with people who came before and the people who will come after us. And I think it's to say that Canada is post-national, I don't think it made any sense. I mean, it was just an empty gesture. If it's post-national, then it's going to be American, or I mean Chinese in 20 years, or whatever is the most powerful national culture that comes to our shores. So it's an empty term. I don't think anybody should. I mean, had you asked them, what do you mean by that? It's like appointing a minister for middle class prosperity without ever defining what middle class is. Mm-hmm. And that existed for a couple of years and nobody ever responded to the question, what do you mean by middle class? And that was quietly put away. But I mean, I'm just going to add, there's a list actually in the book of things that have helped me understand Canada. And those are works of art, movies, dance, companies, plays, novels. And I was hoping people would send me their lists. I have received nothing. Mm. I was hoping somebody would say, okay, you need to watch Kids in the Hall. You need to watch this, right, and the other. Nothing. So we're losing that vernacular. Right. And I don't know. I don't think that's good.
Well, and yeah, you do have a chapter in there mentioning some of what you think, you know, represents Canada or is illustrative of Canada. You also mentioned Northrop Frye. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to discover Northrop Frye? I find this a really fascinating part of the book. And let me mention the title again, Lost in Canada and Immigrant Second Thoughts. And I'm talking with Lydia Perovich, if I've again pronounced the last name correctly. So Lydia, tell us a little bit about your discovery of Northrop Frye, because it comes via family connection.
Yes. Well, I have read various bits from Nori, as they used to call him Nori, before I discovered that this novel, which apparently depicts somebody from my own family, which was written after World War II in Montenegro, was analyzed recently with the help of tools by Northrop Frye. And this sounds very complicated, but Northrop Frye is not very in fashion these days in literary criticism, because he used what preceded literature, current literature, to analyze what's happening in it these days. So he used a lot of Greek myths, Greek and Roman myths, models, Bible stories, things that we don't really read anymore as part of the regular education. And so he would analyze tropes, modes, comedy, all these kinds of things as something that had already happened. So there's this instrumentarium that we can use for our own writing. And it was some fascinating parallels and some fascinating echoes that just go through centuries. And that's, of course, it's not fashionable anymore. We want to know what literature is doing in the real world, how it's representing, whether it's affecting anything, changing anything, adding, what it's adding to the, this is a very pragmatic analysis of the text. And some of it is feminist, some of it is anti-colonial, some of it is post-colonial. There's all these new analysis of the text. So anyway, this an MP in Montenegro, who's also a literary critic, wrote a book about this Montenegrin writer called Mihailo Lalić, who is probably one of the first Montenegrin novelists. And I go into that, why Montenegro didn't really have a long novelistic tradition, probably because they didn't have a long middle-class history, like aristocracy and warriors and peasantry and very thin middle class over the last, from 1700 on to about 1950. It was a, some sort of fortunate mix. Anyway, Northrop Frye emerged in this book about Mihailo Lalić, who wrote a novel with a character who was possibly based on my great uncle, who was a partisan in partisan resistance. So there's all these fine connections that I discovered. It was just such a thrilling experience. And I also discovered Alice Munro had at least a couple of short stories with Montenegrin content. There's so few people actually who know where Montenegro is on the map. But somehow, instead of putting stories in Croatia or Serbia, the two biggest cultures in the region, she somehow connected with Montenegro, and I discovered those two stories. That's another chapter. It's absolutely thrilling. It's like you've been going through your life split. Like there are two parallel splits of you, never really connect, as Foster would say. You got to keep connecting, but it's just very functional. You live in this language, and your past self was in this other language, and the two never really connected. And I discovered these things, and the two spliced together, and you were a whole. So it was an interesting, basically, how literature helped me reconcile both sides of myself and both of my cultures. And
this is a very much an immigrant experience, isn't it? Where you've got to kind of tie together where you came from with where you are, and yet your disappointment now, which was part of the spur for the book of Canada in you know the 2020s, is not quite the Canada of 1999, and it's moving away from. This ability, I mean, you put it in one part of your book, maybe the rampant problem today is, that's another question. But you talk about how you came here to get away from this problem of class and ethnicity, race, sex, religious belief. That's why you came to Canada, to get away from this in Europe and in Montenegro in particular. And now you're back into the soup here. So Northrop Frye, it seems, you know, so the critical theorists these days and those who don't like how he analyzed matters seem to gain to be part of the problem where they're, as I tell people, I mean, I think civilization is an oak tree. They seem to be pouring acid on the roots, the civilizational roots of Canada when they treat people like Northrop Frye, who was a great sort of literary theorist and
absolutely,
because of his understanding of history and, you know, biblical narratives and the rest, could have actually explain Canada to Canadians and who we were, at least in the central Canadian narrative of what Canada is, at the very least. And the same thing with Margaret Atwood. So no, we've lost this. If everything is supposed to be practical, as you put it, or part of an agenda, that you can't read history more honestly or through Greek myths and literary theory and the rest of it. So that's part of the problem. Lydia, let me divert now to a portion of your book that I found really fascinating because very few people write about this and talk about that these days, which is the concept of friendship. You mentioned Aristotle, and of course, others have written about friendship over the decades and the centuries since Aristotle. They include C.S. Lewis and the Four Loves, and he talked about friendship as being one of the overlooked loves or underappreciated loves. Then there was Ralph Waldo Emerson in the 19th century, with an essay in Friendship that talks about why it's so rare, because people are rarely honest with each other. And a friend really is someone you must be completely transparent with. So what kind of sparked your thinking about we all want friends, but what sparked your thinking about friendship and why you think it's in decline in Canada, among other nations?
I think friendship is important because it helps foster virtues that we need to have as good citizens. So I think there's somewhat direct line between good friendship practices and a functioning democracy. Now, of course, this all goes back to Aristotle, which was city-state mm-hmm. he was looking at, and we are complex societies, so that's fine. Perhaps it's only partly relevant. But I think the society on the whole benefits from, let me use that word, virtues and skills that we develop in friendships. And some of those are, you take care of somebody else, you decenter yourself from your life, symmetry is very important in friendships. So if you're only giving or only taking, that's really not friendship. It's different from networking. You're not in it, so your career can benefit. We mistake networking often for friendship. And you're not there for sexual interest. I mean, it might have been a relationship at some point, for example, but not. It shouldn't be a primary goal in a friendship, a sexual relationship. So all these things, and then we learned to practice the virtue of constancy. We learned to practice focus, attention to another person. We practice seeing from another perspective, seeing things from another perspective. And I think all this is really important. And we also carve out a space in our lives that is not for profit. It's not work. It's not our family. It's kind of non-narcissistic. Like love can be very narcissistic and relationship can be very, friendship, not as much. It cannot survive if it is particularly narcissistic. So this is why I think it's bad to lose the practice of friendship. And I am making the argument that we are losing it, especially in North American cities, where there's very little time for these things, especially as people cross into 30s and 40s, have families, have obligations, full-time jobs. Some people would have children, aging parents. There's simply no room for new people. And if we look back at our lives, you can almost precisely say when you close the door in your life for new people, because there's simply no room. There's simply not enough focus.
Is this also a result, perhaps, of how we design modern cities? Because you talk about this, right? When you think about Jane Jacobs' criticism of cities starting in the early 1960s in her book, The Life and Death of American Cities. My recollection of her point there, one of her many points, is the part of New York that she lived in would have been low rises, I think where she lived, as opposed to say high rises. So if we're putting up all these glass towers of 50 stories, there's a natural atomization that takes place, as opposed to say a four-story walk-up or something, and where you're looking into the neighborhood and into the park from your, you know, you're an elderly grandmother looking down on the street and all these things that Jane Jacobs talks about. So is it the loss of community as well? Does the design of our cities these days, and I'm you know, in general pro-immigration, but is the fact that we're trying to stuff so many people into a couple of cities in Canada, basically, where you don't have the room to expand outward, or you're not allowed to expand outward anymore, and we're building upward, does this contribute to the loss of friendship? Because in essence, or neighborliness, which, you know, you may find a friend in a neighbor, because you don't have that when you're in these small apartments in a 50-story building. And you don't necessarily naturally have contact in a way you might in a more low rise or even in suburbia, where, you know, for all the mockery that some like to make of suburbia, you can, you know, lean over the fence, as people say, and make a friend. So is that part of it, how we design our cities upward and not outward anymore? Is that part of the problem?
Yes, I'm so glad you caught that and you're taking that part of my argument seriously. I do think it matters that it's the top goal of Toronto Life, for example, is to have a house, to own your own house, and to have your plot of land. I mean, maybe this comes from Englishman's home, it's his own castle ideology that comes from British Empire. Somehow living in an apartment, even if it's really a nice apartment, like Paris, Berlin, Amsterdam, a whole bunch of Europe, just you grow up in an apartment. And mm-hmm. if you're a wealthy person, you really have a fancy apartment. And if you want a house, you have to go outside the city.
But they're not 50-story skyscrapers until recently, right? They are 4-story, 6-story walk-ups. So do, exactly. do you think that design actually helps?
This is it. They have been rezoned. They had visionary rezoners in the history of the cities, and they have been rezoned multiple times. We did not have that. Mm. And so our yellow belt is the untouched, huge swath of the city of Toronto, where you're not allowed to develop, not even gently. It's a big, big uproar if you even try to do infill or alleyway housing, extraordinary. And then you have maybe 2 or 3 kilometer square where all the development happens. And this is where I live. I have 5 new towers in the last 3 years, and it's mad. And in that little section of, which is downtown effectively, you topple now, you remove mid-rises to put 50 story towers. And it does, of course, it affects social life. I mean, this is, and it has to do with the bowling alone argument as well that Robert Putnam did propose many decades ago. And recently, his more famous study is about how diversity, ethnic diversity, religious diversity, and its under management, let's put it that way, can affect social trust detrimentally. Right. So effectively, I mean, that totally tracks with my experience in a big North American city where 50% of the people were born somewhere else and it's huge, huge ethnic diversity. We tend to hunker down. When we have all these options, we hunker down within our own ethnic group. We go to our own ethnic groups, bowling leagues, or community centers and all that. And I mean, I had a friend who had a job at Rogers and he would say, cafeteria during lunch hour, everybody would have their own ethnic table. So it's very strange. It's a defense mechanism, I think, to against this enormity of a North American city where potentially everything is possible. There's too many choices.
Without the magnetic pull of a central unifying vision of what Canada is, right? Back to your point about nationalism, or a healthy type of civic nationalism, which the Americans have or the French have. Right, where we've divided in this for some time because of the tensions historically between English and French Canada, and now the question of Indigenous Canadians, you know, and everyone else, you know, that divide. The city, I think it's somewhat natural for immigrants to segment off into communities in which they're comfortable. Like they know their routine, they know the expectations, right? When I think of my grandparents that moved to Edmonton, my grandmother first, and she met my grandfather later in Edmonton and married in 1933, they were part of a German community there. They went to a German church. It makes sense to me, right? Because my grandmother didn't know English initially. She had no education, actually. She never learned how to read or write. So it makes sense to me that, you know, anyone, when you move to a new country, you're going to find some people at least that are familiar, unless you're really great at learning language quickly or really want to dive into the other culture. So at least the first generation, I understand that. But these days, I guess the presence of the internet, we can kind of prolong this balkanization, so to speak, and that's the best word for it, in tribalism. And in fact, there is no, especially in Canada, with a prime minister who believes in a post-national state, not just a post-ethnic state, but no unifying vision other than let's all get along, which may be naive. Long question, but does this again remind you of the worst parts of Europe where, listen, you do this for too long without a unifying vision, you may end up in a problem?
Yes. Yes. In short, yes. And I don't think we even see that it's a problem that a whole bunch of ethnic groups that have nothing in common except municipal problems. I don't think anybody looks above and beyond the municipal issues of garbage pickup, parks, whether there's water fountain, whether daycares are working well. That something needs to be on offer for all these different groups, some sort of narrative, some options, some creation of meaning that they can share, that we can share. And I don't think this exists at the moment. I can't tell what unifies us. I guess maybe a city that we live in part unifies us, but that's where it ends. That's really where it ends. And it is total balkanization and optimization. Worse, you if you come from a smaller ethnic group, like I do, I mean, not a Chinese, not Indian, there are no pre-existing infrastructures for me, community centers for me, and I wouldn't want them. I mean, there's a class difference in the waves of immigration, right? The previous generations tended to be working class, working to middle, and from the 90s on, any kind of immigration that we get, or even 80s, because our system is so highly selective. It would be super educated people, middle classes, who already have some established in their countries and that kind of thing. So this kind of posh immigration, if you want to put it that way, I mean, I'm far from being even middle income. I'm happily low and stable low income, but I am extremely privileged in that I'm educated. I speak English with no problem. And I actually am working in my chosen profession extremely hard. If you come from humanities, if you come from STEM, you'll be much more in demand. But if you come from humanities, it's going to be very different. But we are kind of the overeducated immigration than in the last 20 years, 30 years that I hope Canada is benefiting from.
I think most people would agree, yeah, immigration is a net benefit. I think there's some concerns about specific, again, the lack of a unifying vision for people that may arrive here. And in fact, like you arrived here thinking this is a good, liberal democratic country. And if that breaks down, if there's no unifying vision of what Canada should be, then you've got a bit of a problem, right? Because it's not eminently practical. I wrote about this years ago in the Globe and Mail when I was trying to explain, look, it's one thing, of course, to have a young 20-something doctor from Islamabad who's female who wants to practice medicine in Canada and has, beliefs that may be very similar to others in Toronto, for example. It's another thing to have someone from maybe the Northwest part of Afghanistan or Pakistan, who's 65 years old and doesn't think women should, have the right to vote or do much of anything. Those are two very different types of immigrants, right? And so again, what is it that people want out of Canada when they come here, whether it's my grandparents or yourself, and is that breaking down? Let's jump a little bit in.
Fascinatingly, it's this generation that was born here, that grew up here, finds way towards radicalization. And this is what's happening with Islamic fundamentalist jihadists in Europe.
Right. So second generation.
It's extremely rare that it's the person who comes because they're eager to belong. They're hardworking. They don't, I'm not into fuss. Right. I just want to blend in. And it's the kids, probably in search of meaning, probably in search of some history, some roots, that they ended up in these womb-like religions that just swallow them and give them meaning.
And they don't have the remembrance as their parents might of what happened in the old country.
Exactly.
Right. The same reason European immigrants, post-World War II said, let's leave all that behind, or Americans founded their nation with a reaction to the tribalism of Europe. Let's jump. We've got about 10 minutes, I think, left here. Let's jump a little bit into some of these problems that you see nowadays, which is creating this or reinforcing the balkanization. You talk about, I thought it was a wonderful phrase you came up with on page 140 of Lost in Canada and Immigrant Second Thoughts. And I'm talking with Lydia Perovich. On page 140 of the book, though, you talk about offense archaeology. Can you explain that term and what it signifies?
It's one of the strangest things that have emerged from online political activism that's spilling over in real life activism. You dig out for words, for concepts that sound from mildly offensive to outrageous today. Mm. And this could be anything from bit in Louis. I don't know if you've seen Louis Riel's opera, Louis Riel, the opera.
No.
So it's one of my favorite pieces of Canadiana, and also one of my favorite operas. But the composer used one of the arias is vaguely based on an indigenous lullaby that he might have heard recorded and then used, again, mediated by multiple artistic, processes into the aria. And it's one of the most beautiful parts of the opera. It had to be removed.
Mm.
And a Métis composer had to be hired to redo that. So suddenly that, something that Bartok did, that a whole bunch of European composers did, recording folk music and saving it for posterity, but also using it in their own work, that's not recommended anymore. So that suddenly, within the last 5 years, became not acceptable. I have a friend who's a Jewish woman who dedicated her entire life to studying DNA language. Is that how you pronounce this? DNA?
Yeah.
That's it. And if she was starting out today, I don't think she would have been accepted as an academic in this field. Mm. So it's...
Isn't this crazy? Again, it's, and you talk about this in the book, the purity kind of belief. this cultural purity, which is actually really dangerous. And you would recognize this coming from Europe, this notion that people need to be culturally pure. This is the most dangerous development I see, one of the most dangerous developments I see in Western culture these days in Canada, this notion that we should be all culturally pure. The Germans were heavily into that in the 19th century, long before they came to race purity. And people, but literally, but people these days don't understand they're imitating the worst of Germany in the 1800s on, we need to be culturally pure. Really? Are you sure about that? And of course, it tells people that they can't have a shared humanity. I mean, Alexander Solzhenitsyn talked about Soviet dissident talked about how people look at each other and they see the other person as evil. You know, I saw this in the Gulag when he was there. And if only you get rid of this other person, this other tribe, all will be well. And he said, no, you missed the point. The dividing line between good and evil is in each human heart. Absolutely. And so this loss of shared humanity or this loss of even cultural sharing, that's now considered cultural appropriation. And again, but as a practical matter, if you're going to tell people they can't write about someone else's culture, then I guess people lose interest. Do you think in terms of you come
then from fiction's arts and, done that fiction's done, literature's done,
right?
Art's pretty much done.
Is it also, and, I mean, so it's you hollowing can make, it out? Is it also that it's going to make it less popular? Like when I think about politically correct is an overused term, but identity politics and the rest of it, is this also frankly making a weak arts and culture community in Canada also less attractive to people who otherwise might be interested in it because they see it as being completely politicized and ideological, as opposed to people who used to just want to write great plays, great books, great dramas, great music. And now they're being told they have to fill out, you know, some quota sheet if they're the right proportion, the right skin color, the right whatever. Doesn't that just make arts and culture boring? And in fact, is hollowing it out even more? Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, absolutely. And we're tuning out. This is probably why we're tuning out to such a drastic degree from our own culture, because it's become an equity, diversity, inclusion project. And you really have to now specify. Mm. I don't know if you watched the Canada Council launch of their new mandate. I don't know how to call it.
On the edges, I seem to recall there's some weird stuff going on there in terms of, again, all of these things, as opposed to what used to be about finding good art.
Extraordinary. It's an ideological project. Mm. And my publisher had a good point. He says, imagine if it's different party in government and they have their own idea. How would you react if the Prime Minister Pierre Poilievre demanded that...
That you write only pro-free market screeds in art. The arts community would go nuts.
Long, like 20-part series about trucker convoy and, you know, things like that. And people are not wise when they're doing this because these things remain embedded in institutions and then governments change and then, oh, wow, maybe that wasn't a good idea. No, it's extraordinary. You should not start art making with an ideological project, social justice project, any kind of that, things like that. I mean, when we're creating art, when we're writing novels, it's always one solitude addressing the other and finding the other. That's the bridging. And that's what conversation happens. It doesn't happen in a group or ethnic minority in an ethnic majority, for example. No, it's not how it happens. But this discourse have now taken over completely.
Do you see, we'll close off here in a few moments, and I want to bring up a marvelous part of the last part of the book, relevant to Alberta, actually, on a lighter note. But before we go to the lighter note, do you see any hope that we're going to get away from this pollution of the arts and culture in Canada and literature and the rest of it, and all that Canada was when you came here in 1999? And you're concerned that we're headed towards the tribalism of Europe, and all that implies in the dangerous sense. Do you have any room for optimism that this has now reached its peak, this absurdity, the practice of identity politics, of ethnic fracturing?
Double think, which is the worst thing.
Which we haven't talked about today, but absolutely.
Something that you talk, one way you talk about with your friends privately and completely a different way you talk in public, that is extremely dangerous.
Well, you have a recollection of that from Europe, or at least you would recall your parents and grandparents having to deal with this under communism, right? Absolutely. In the former Yugoslavia, now Montenegro. So this double thing. So, but are you optimistic that this will end sometime soon, that people are getting fed up with this? Like, do you see anything below the surface here?
never ask a question from the Balkans if they're optimistic.
Okay, fair enough.
But okay, I'm working on it. I'm trying to adopt the North American optimistic view of the world where we have to think something, think up something so it would happen. Okay. But if you approach things like, oh, it's never going to happen, it isn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. So let's force ourselves to be optimistic, but people will have to speak up. Mm-hmm. And the institutions will have to withstand. A lot of the institutions have been captured because majority kept remain silent. And there's a minority of ardent activists who are ready to shame, to, you know, ask for people to be fired. And majority is being silent. So people need to start talking and speaking up. And please, Canadians, save your culture.
That's a wonderful place to end. Thank you, Lydia. And I want to end on this note, and I'll mention who I am and then end on this. So you've been watching Interviews with a Contrarian, or Interview with a Contrarian in this particular case. I'm Mark Milkey, Executive Director of the Aristotle Foundation for Public Policy, a new think tank we hope to launch later this year. But let me end with this, Lydia. What I loved about the end, or what brought up a memory, is you mentioned a particular shop in Banff, which is about an hour and a half from where I live in Calgary. And you have a favorite candy from Banff. And I've been to the shop. Can you describe for our viewers what you found in Banff?
Is that the chocolate fudge?
It is. Yeah. And isn't that a wonderful shop, the chocolate
fudge? Does it exist?
It still exists.
Fabulous.
There's a chocolate fudge shop.
I think Banff is the westmost I've been in Canada. Mm-hmm. Well, Banff is a bit more west than Edmonton, right?
Calgary south of Edmonton, and Banff is west of Calgary. Yes.
And loved every single thing about it. It was just a different, the Rockies are something special. And of course, the wonderful arts center that I'm sure it also is changing along ideological lines. I haven't checked in a long time, but I hope it's not. Yes, that chocolate fudge place is such a delight. And I bought a wallet with Alberta's insignia and a moose and all that. And I'm still using that wallet. It's my favorite wallet.
That's marvelous. Yes, the fudge shop is still there. It's very popular. And whenever I go there, I try and buy some of that. And maybe that's a great way to end as well. I mean, what Banff represents, or what the Rockies represents, is that there are some almost eternal verities, right? The Rockies don't change that quickly, right? It took, tens of millions of years, or more than that, to get to what the Rockies look like today. Absolutely. So one day the fudge shop will be gone and you and I will be gone, but the Rockies will still be there in all their magnificent splendor. And there is something to paying attention to the deep currents of history, perhaps, the deep realities of history when you take part in a national project, which is what Canada is. So perhaps that's the most positive way to end. Thank you, Lydia, and all the best and success in your book, Lost in Canada and Immigrant Second Thoughts. I hope it does sell well, and I hope this interview has prompted some sales. Thank you, Lydia.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Thank you.